mean, I think this is the secret, with, or it's the key to all specialist media. You cannot be successful in the specialist media market if you're not really into the subject matter, and also give up any ideas of ever getting rich from it.
Hello and welcome to Media Voices. I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston. And that quote you just heard is from Mark Alker, publisher of Singletrackworld.com, Europe's biggest mountain biking website, and Singletrack magazine, a bi-monthly print publication. And as well as the secrets of success for specialised media, we spoke about community, coffee, and Mark's love-hate relationship with programmatic.
Now, you may have noticed somebody is missing. Chris, Peter and I have all gone down with kind of various lurgy since the podcast awards. So Chris is in bed this week. But we do just want to say a big thank you to all the guests, sponsors and everybody else who helped make the Publisher Podcast Awards happen. It was a brilliant and very, very late night.
Maybe it's just like a 4-day hangover he's got.
Maybe. And if you want to be there next year, entries for 2021 are going to open in September, so you can sign up at publisherpodcastawards.com for more.
Oh my God, 2021.
It'll be here before we know it.
But before we get to 2021, we've got the news roundup. And a good news story to start off with. So The Independent has reported its third consecutive year of profits since going digital only. Their advertising revenue is up 10%. They've got profits of 2.3 million on a 27 million turnover, which is pretty good going. I think the interesting part of this for me, Esther, is the fact that they're actually talking so much about how much more they're spending on editorial. I think they spent 12% more in 2018, 2019 on editorial teams.
So wait a second, you're telling me that if you invest in editorial, you make money?
Who knew?
I feel like there are a lot of publishers who could learn from this.
I think there's more going on than that. But I think what's interesting is the fact that in all the press releases, all the PR that I've seen for this, they're really touting this. They're saying, this is what we're doing. This is the secret of our success, kind of thing.
But the one of the stories I saw about this framed it in a slightly odd way. It said it was an FT article that said that profits at The Independent have overtaken The Telegraph's. So I think they're now more profitable than The Telegraph Media Group, aren't they? Which it was just a bit of an odd comparison.
Yeah, Telegraph Media Group's profits were 900,000 in 2018. Mm. But they've got 10 times the revenue of The Independent. You know, and if you do another comparison, The Guardian, who's just backing profit with an operating profit of 800,000. So The Independent is more profitable than that. But the real point with that is about they've lost the print costs, they've lost the distribution costs, they've lost the actual physical manufacturing costs. That's why they're profitable. So it's a little bit, well, it's a justification for going digital only in The Independent's case. But it's now a question of comparing apples and oranges rather than apples and apples, I think.
And I mean, I think the article pointed out as well that a lot of the growth has been places like the US, where you wouldn't necessarily have been able to grow print subscribers.
Yeah,
what was it, 18% year on year and 30 million monthly uniques, which put it ahead of Vice and Vox, which
That's nuts. I thought that was amazing, that their monthly uniques are bigger than Vice and Vox. Which is, I don't know, why is that? Is it because it's seen as an independent voice?
Are people Googling independent news?
Oh, maybe.
I don't know.
They're so sick of the partisan stuff that's going on.
But I mean, the I newspaper, which they sold off a couple of years ago, is also doing quite well on its own. So that's an interesting.
Yeah, case. Maybe part of this is about the format, that idea that the eyes format is very accessible, it's easy to read, it's a quick read, it's not that broadsheet thing that's going on. And one of the things that FT article you're talking about talks about is this kind of move when they went online only, this catchy lifestyle related content, which is not quite what the paper had. You know, the paper was originally seen as a quality broadsheet that was going up against The Guardian on the left and Times and The Telegraph on the right. So I don't know. I don't know if it's something to do with the format, if it's something to do with the reporting and the spending the investment on getting more international coverage. I don't know if it's just dumb luck because it's independent is a thing that people want now. I don't know. But it's definitely good news.
Yeah.
Got to be seen as good news. I mean, I think there was a weird quote on this. John Patton, who's the chair of Independent Digital News and Media, a holding company, claimed that the group had become a truly unicorn, which I thought is that's kind of weird. A unicorn in this context usually means Uber or...
I thought unicorns tend to mean companies that start up very young, very quick, grow ridiculously quickly, and then it turns out that the funding is actually all smoke and mirrors and they actually make no money.
But I think, so the point of this is these guys have actually got 2.3 million worth of profit, so but I think the other thing that maybe he's trying to get at is this idea that they were the first UK national quality newspaper to go online only, and they've made a good job of it. So that's maybe what he's getting at, is that idea that, you know, this digital only strategy has definitely paid off and maybe other people can learn from it. I don't know, you know, the idea of the Telegraph or the Times or the Guardian becoming digital only. You know, again, if Chris was here, he'd be talking about that tipping point thing and it's coming. But I just don't see it. I don't see it anytime soon. I think print is still going to go over these guys.
But I suppose it is a nice hope for people that if they are looking, or if print does reach that point that it is unsustainable, that actually you can survive. I think, what was it, that the digital ad revenues don't necessarily compensate for the print loss, but when you don't have the print costs, you can have a sustainable digital news site.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was that was commented. Was it Charlie Beckett in that FT article? He made that point. You know, this isn't about getting back to where it used to be. This is about a totally new business model.
Yeah, because I mean, like, their revenue has doubled since they dropped the print, which, I mean, yeah, okay, yeah, it's taken time to grow that, but that's still, what was it, 2016 they dropped that?
Yeah, but actual overall revenue won't have doubled. That's just digital revenue that's doubled.
Okay.
So it's not, you're not making up those print losses. It's a completely new way of doing things because you don't have the print costs.
Yeah.
Thanks. It's an interesting one.
That's a good one. Nice, hopeful.
Well done. I don't know if this next one is a good news story or a bad news story, but Bloomberg News is returning to normal coverage of the US election after Mike Bloomberg dropped out of the presidential race this week. I don't even know what to say about this story.
I have some things to say, but I'm going to explain what it is first.
Okay, go on.
So, I mean, I know we covered this a couple of months back when Mike Bloomberg said he'd run for Democratic president. And the staff at Bloomberg were then like, okay, this is really awkward. And they were then told that they would have to treat the nominees differently. They weren't allowed to run, like, in-depth investigations of Bloomberg. They weren't allowed to investigate other Democratic nominees, but they were allowed to go hell for leather for Trump.
I do remember this story. It was one of the times where I actually thought Trump actually maybe had a point.
Yeah, yeah. And Trump stood there and was like, well, this is exactly what I've been going on about for the last few years. They've just come out and said what they're doing. But it does, that at that time raised that huge question of what happens when you've got somebody as president or potential president who owns, like, a huge media arm like that. Yeah. But that now seems to kind of be done and dusted because, the US election system makes ours look like it was done with crayons. Bloomberg dropped, actually, a different, Mike Bloomberg dropped out of the Democratic presidential race last Wednesday. I think it was his first time on the ballot box and it was pretty disappointing, but he'd spent $550 million on ad buys. But yeah, he seems to kind of come to the conclusion that actually he stands more of a, he just wants to defeat Trump and that he stands more of a chance of doing that if by dropping out the race and getting behind the other candidates.
So is he going to spend money with the other candidates?
I don't know.
Yeah, but American politics is mental.
I know. But it does now mean that Bloomberg News can get back to business as usual and can run investigations into whoever they want. But I suppose that there's always going to be the question now, isn't there, that are they now going to have that kind of bias towards Democratic candidates?
But also that I saw a thing that Bernie Sanders was saying that, you know, it's, if everyone's having a go at the media, it's not good. But Bernie Sanders was saying that the media bias is in favour of the elites for people with money, and he's saying that in a different way than Trump, because Trump is actually one of the elites.
Yeah.
So it seems like a mess. It seems like everyone's having a go at the media, and no one's coming out of it well.
Yeah. The editor-in-chief, John Micklethwaite, has said in a memo to staff that now that Mike has said he's leaving the race for president, we'll return to our normal coverage of the election and we'll follow exactly the same coverage rules for the Democratic presidential candidates and President Donald Trump. And I feel like when you have to issue a memo like that, something somewhere down the line has gone wrong. Well, but it's not an easy situation.
No, it's not. So we're just doing this COVID-19 news in brief.
Well, I think it's a very thematic news in brief we've got now, given that both of us have got colds and Chris is out. We haven't got a coronavirus, we should
none
just
say. None of us have coronavirus. We should make it very clear. And you certainly can't catch coronavirus from a podcast. So you're
no,
okay.
We've just got the good old British cold.
Yeah. So now the reason we did this was that COVID-19 is everywhere in the news, as everyone is aware, and we just thought it was worth rounding up how media is dealing with it and what's going on. Oh, perfect timing. So one of the most interesting things that I saw in this was a piece that Casey Newton did. Is it the Interchange newsletter?
Yes, Interface.
Interface, sorry. In the Interface newsletter. Where he sees hopeful signs that big tech companies and social platforms are actually taking meaningful action to direct people to timely, accurate information about the virus. Facebook's put a box in the news feed that sends people to information from, I think, in America it's the CDC, and I think it's the NHS in the UK.
Yeah.
And then they've offered free ads to the World Health Organization, which is pretty positive.
Twitter's got an info box, and I don't know what a zero tolerance policy on misinformation actually means in practice.
Yeah, I think there's the next story points to their zero tolerance policy probably not working. But the point is, they're saying that anyone found putting that out will be barred and banned, and the usual Twitter-worthy response that it will be really difficult to implement.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, Pinterest have been taking a really hard line on all sorts of things recently, and they've now just got, if you search for coronavirus, it just has no search results.
Yeah. I think the only thing it will do is it will point you to established health, like the World Health Organization, for example. It will let that through.
Yeah, it does that if you search for vaccines now.
Yeah, the anti-vaxxer approach to it. Google apparently is going to give people free streaming if they're customers, so they can work from home. And Apple is rejecting coronavirus apps that aren't from health organisations. So I guess they're all banding together. The fact that Casey Newton says that it's hopeful signs big tech companies are changing is quite a good thing.
But these steps are all necessary because people suck and there's just a ton of virus misinformation out there.
I read this thing in the New York Times and it's mental. It's like, you know, stories about race riots in Italy and against Chinese or Asian people and government plots, and this was created in a Chinese government lab.
There's a concerning number of sane people that I've heard come out with that theory, and I think it's because somebody wrote about it in a book like 15 years ago, and it's been circulating, and people have now kind of been like, oh, that's actually what's happened, rather than no, that was from a fiction novel.
Yeah. Getting movie plot lines confused with truth. Oof. Jesus.
I'll add a sniff.
That's awful. The World Health Organization has actually said that we're confronting an infodemic.
That's
mental. Infodemic.
Yeah, I love the word infodemic, not the actual infodemic.
Heard George Osborne on the radio this morning talking about immunising or inoculating the economy against coronavirus, and I thought, oh Jesus, George, give us a break. But anyway, apparently Facebook, Google and Twitter are all removing misinformation about coronavirus as fast as they can find it, but we know how that story ends.
Yeah, we do. That's the thing, it's all very noble to have these stances, but how on earth, how do you keep up with people producing so much stuff?
Mental. Because, as you said, humans suck. And not one to miss a chance to beat up in the press, Donald Trump has claimed that the fake news media is doing everything possible to make the American government look bad on its coronavirus response. He is absolutely mental.
But I suppose there are some legitimate criticisms that, like, the media hype around this has just been so ridiculous, and often it's coming from people who aren't actually informed on the matter.
Yeah.
And I think there's some press watchers that suggest that actually political reporters should probably not be reporting on coronavirus. It should be health reporters, because this is not, at the moment, this should not be a political issue. This should be a health issue.
Yeah. No, on that Press Watchers website, there was a story about that saying it's too damned important to be covered as a two-sided battle over who's winning the narrative, and I think that's true. But again, you know, politics is politics. They're going to have a go at each other for whatever. But there is some good news according to DigiDay. Broadcasters are using their streaming services rather than their linear TV services to add and update coronavirus coverage. You know, basically they can slot stuff in locally, they can slot stuff in as and when it breaks, so they've got much more flexibility broadcast wise to get stuff in than if it was a proper linear TV schedule. So I guess we all benefit from streaming services.
Talk of benefiting from things, my favourite story this week.
Yeah, this is the best.
An Australian paper has printed blank pages to help tackle toilet paper shortages. The 8 pages in the paper were left blank except for watermarks. And yeah, I think actually we are down to our last 2 toilet rolls. As a normal non-panicky human being, I am now starting to slightly panic that I'm not going to be able to get loo roll when we need it next.
But I think it was Adam Tinworth who was saying now there's 2 types of people in Britain. There's the people that panic buy toilet roll and the people that refuse to buy toilet roll in case anyone thinks they're panic buying. Oh, man. I love the guy's quote on this. He says the banner headline on this was "Run out of loo paper, the NT News cares." And then the editor says, the editor Matt Williams says, "It definitely wasn't a crappy edition."
Yeah, I've seen all sorts of things on Twitter about, you know, this is what newspapers are finally good for.
That's ridiculous. I'm not having that. This week I spoke with Mark Alcock, publisher of the Single Track magazine and website. We talked about using newsstand sales as a subscription marketing tool and his ambitions to reverse Single Track's ratio of reader versus programmatic revenues. But first I asked Mark to share the history of Single Track magazine.
We've been going since 2001. We're a mountain bike magazine predominantly, although recently we've branched out into other disciplines. But yeah, we kicked off, we were a print magazine. Actually, to be honest, let's rewind. Before 2001, we started off as an online website only in the .com bubble, which promptly burst as soon as we got in there. It was our fault, that was it. We couldn't get anybody to pay for advertising. I think we had one advertiser buying a banner. We decided that, kind of ironically for the time, that the future lay in print. So we decided to take it, not offline, but we decided to take the long form stuff we were doing and put that into print. And so we launched our first print title in 2001. But we kept with the website and we kind of differentiated online content with magazine content. So we kept all the long form stuff in print. And we did all the sort of daily news type things and a forum online, and the two worked together from the word go in 2001. We did launch on, funnily enough, on April the 1st, 2001. And that was right smack bang in the middle of the foot and mouth crisis. So I think we were an outdoor magazine launching at a time when nobody could go outdoors.
So it's been uphill ever since, which is probably not the best for a mountain bike magazine, really.
No, well, we do go up. We do go up. We go up to go down. So, yeah, it kind of works.
So you're still in print. You're still publishing in print.
We're still publishing in print. Print's really important to us.
And it's every couple of months, is it?
Yeah, we're bi-monthly. We've gone from, we started quarterly, then we went to 6. And then I remember we made a decision to go up from 6, and we decided, what should we do? Should we do 8? And then everybody panicked and thought, we can't fit 8 in. So I made one of the most awkward decisions that we've ever done, which is we went to 7 issues a year. Nice. which caused havoc with the accounts and cash flow. Because we couldn't predict when anybody was going to pay us at all, because 7 does not go into 12.
Nope.
So we retired. I think we went up to 8, and then we're down to 6.
And what drives that frequency decision? Is it just whether you get enough advertising, or is it?
I have to say, yeah, because we've got a big online presence. For us, the frequency principally came down to advertising, how much we could make from each printed issue. Yeah. And so that was principally the driver there.
I've heard you describe your print presence as an ongoing battle. You know, and it's clearly one you love, or you wouldn't still be doing it, but it is a struggle. So what's the issue there?
Well, I guess the issue is, how would I say this? Print is the core of our brand, because we started with print. Everybody knew us as print. And in the industry that we're in, print still to this day commands a level of respect that gets us through the doors of a lot of big industry names like Shimano and Specialized and Trek. And I think there's a recognition in the industry that whereas anybody can publish anything from their bedroom, to actually still today to be in print, that's really difficult to do. That's really bloody hard to do. And I think that gives us a level of credibility within the industry that we certainly don't want to lose. So, we're still in print with a huge online presence to back it up.
What's your distribution in print? Is it through retail or is it direct? Or?
Yeah, well, we're around about 6,000 subscribers, and we stick around sort of 4,000 into the news trade. So we are there on the high street. We're on W.H. Smith shelves and various independents. So yeah, it's a combination of the two. News trade has been the biggest challenge of the last few years, because the efficiencies are just bloody awful. Mm. So we've tried to concentrate our print offering to our subscribers. We tried to make it a real... Basically, we're trying to use the newsstand as a marketing platform to get subscribers. And we have different covers on our subscriber copies to the ones that go into the newsstand. And we have more pages in the subscriber copy.
So it's like people see it in W.H. Smith's or wherever, love it, and take a subscription.
That's it. We're using the newsstand as discovery and trying to then convert.
So how do you do that inside the magazine? What is it, special offers that you're giving people, or is it special content, or how do you convert people inside the magazine like that?
Well, we do put stitched in inserts with voucher codes and the usual traditional things, but what we do is the last 32 pages of the magazine. The newsstand version's 116 pages and the subscriber copy is 148. Right. So the newsstand copy, when you pick it up, as you move to the back, the last page in the magazine is actually an advert telling you what you're not getting and that you would get if you were a subscriber. So we list all the articles in there that are subscriber only, and then we put an offer at the bottom. So that's it tends to work. It's kind of old school, but yeah.
Well, that idea of old school is kind of coming back again, because people are putting so much emphasis on reader revenues. We've talked about this separately, but I know why that is. But for you, what's the benefit of that kind of reader revenue?
That reader revenue, well, there's a loyalty that's built in with that, but principally the reader revenue is security. Those subscriptions, that, like I said before, we can bank them a year in advance. Yeah. And I think for a business to be able to look ahead 12 months and go, this is what we are scheduled to receive, is very, very powerful. That's kind of like the bedrock of the financial bedrock of our business. Mm-hmm. With advertising, of course, we've got, especially programmatic, I've got no idea sometimes what we're even going to earn tomorrow.
So can you talk about the split?
Yeah, we are approximately 40% reader revenue, 60% advertising. Yep. And I would love that to switch. We would much prefer to have the majority of our revenue come from reader-generated revenues.
So you basically want more reader revenue because it's more predictable than you've got in terms of advertising, yeah?
Absolutely. It's within our control. Advertising, marketing, what the industry wants to do, what they want to spend their money on, that's out of our control. What we sell to our readers, what we offer them, what they want, that is within our control.
And it's your advertising mostly online, or I mean, you've got print advertising, but what's the balance between online and print?
Online advertising is pretty much double what our print advertising is.
Right.
Although in the last 2 years, we've actually seen a small increase in our print revenues. I think we've gone up about 5% year on year for the last 2 years.
Oh, you're the magazine that did that. Wow.
Yeah, all right. But I think the power of that is because we're selling more campaigns now. Rather than just selling a page, we're combining it with digital offerings so that when we can go to our advertisers, we can say, well, here's a spread. We can give you everything. We can give you social media. We can give you video. We can give you online advertising and sponsorship. And we can also give you print. So we're selling more packages. And I think overall, that's actually lifted our print revenues.
In terms of digital, what is that advertising? Is it banners? Is it anchor positions? Or are you selling programmatic?
Programmatic. Where do we start with that? we get a lot of revenue from programmatic. And I
that would be so sad.
I know it's I do hate it. I hate it simply because a lot of our programmatic revenue first of all gets paid in dollars. And the thing is that when Donald Trump can put out a tweet about China and all of a sudden the exchange rate goes through the floor and we've lost a few hundred dollars in a day. So, you know, it's and Boris Johnson does something daft and again, the exchange rate gets hit and our revenues change. You know, I didn't get into this business to battle with exchange rates and politics.
Currency arbitrage.
Yes, indeed. And also it's so unpredictable. And that's the hateful thing about programmatic. And I don't know whether our programmatic revenues are going to be high tomorrow or whether they're going to be low. And so, that's a kind of we're saddled with it. Like I said, it's a large amount of money, but I hate the unpredictability of it.
But if I described you as a smaller publisher, you wouldn't be offended by that.
No, not at all. We are. We're at the arse end of Yorkshire. There's 10 of us here.
So to get to grips with programmatic must have been quite a daunting challenge.
It was. I'd say it's an evolution. We were with it from the start. I mean, we had AdSense running through Google from the word go. And then it got to the point where there was other providers and then things like, I got very familiar with words and vocabulary like the stack. And for a long time, I was actually manually managing a stack of a whole bunch of programmatic providers and literally looking at what they were earning and then shifting them around. So yeah, there was the stack, which we called I called that the shit shower, because it was just such an awful thing to manage.
But was it worth it in the end?
I have to say it has, because we rely on that revenue. It's a large part of our revenue stream.
So if there was another small publisher out there that was terrified of programmatic, would you say suck it up?
There's lots of talk about how this is the end days of banner advertising, and there's a certain amount of truth in that, but they aren't going away anytime soon. And as a small publisher, I think there are options out there where you can just plug in, switch them on, forget about them. Mm. I think our problem is we've always had a kind of a complicated relationship with advertising. And so, for example, our subscriptions, if you're a subscriber, you don't see any advertising on the website whatsoever. Mm. If you register on our website and log in, then you see fewer ads. Mm. If you just pop along to the website and just tune in once or twice, every week, then you're going to see maximum number of ads. So we actually leverage the unpopularity of advertising to try and get people to join in the community and become subscribers. So yeah, it's a kind of a complicated relationship we have with advertising.
The banner ad is a conversion tool.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Yes, subscribe or we'll just stick more of these things in front of your face.
So one of the things that you mentioned earlier was the forum on your website. You said you've been running that for years.
Yes.
And I had a look before I spoke with you, and it's mental. There's loads going on there.
A lot of our competitors over the year have run forums, and I think we've done something slightly different that's kept it alive. Social media came along and our forum didn't seem to actually lose much traffic because of that, but other forums did. And I think what we've done, the unique thing, we've done two things. One, we have just two forums. There's a chat forum and there's a bike forum, and that's it. We've seen a lot of forums out there where they subdivide all these different topics. So there's other bike websites out there that have got forums that if you're into full suspension mountain bikes, here's a forum for you. If you are into single speeds or fat bikes, there's an individual forum for you. And what we've shied away from that. We've decided to keep everybody in the same room. And that's, I think that's led to a sort of a success that it's just one big melting pot and everything's there. But we also look after that forum. We actually moderate it to a high level. We have a dedicated team of volunteer moderators who enforce some kind of strict rules. And also we have a system of moderate self-moderation so that the community itself can report anything untoward. And so I think those two things, that sort of keeping it simple, keeping it a single melting pot, and having an active team of moderators who are literally there 24/7 looking after it, has meant that the thing's flourished where others have perhaps not.
Why do you think this still works when you've got the likes of Facebook or you've got, you know, what other social media platforms going on?
I think what the way that we've always kind of explained our forum, it's a bit like a pub. And the most popular part of our forum, considering that we're actually a mountain bike website, the most popular forum is the chat forum. And the chat forum is specifically nothing to do with bikes. So the analogy we've always drawn with our forum is it's a bit like a pub. And if you are a mountain biker and you go out with your mates maybe once or twice a week and there's a group of you, you go out riding your bikes, and then you come back and you end up in the pub, you sit down with your pint, and then you start talking. And the one thing you're not talking about is you're not talking about bikes at that point. You're talking about everything. You're talking about life. You're talking about politics. And so that's kind of, that only works when you've got an actual community where people know each other. And there's an awful lot of anonymity about social media that means you don't get that sense of belonging. And I think that's been pretty much key to why our forum's still as strong as it is. That and the fact that it SEOs so well.
Really?
Yes. There's a few. Well, I challenge you to do this and your listeners. Oh, go to Google and type in how to kill a tree. And I guarantee on the first page you'll get our forum. So, yeah, I can't honestly say that the success of our forum is entirely down to mountain biking. But it's definitely down to building a community.
So the other thing that's even more surprising, I think, is your classified section. So why is these people not selling this stuff on eBay? Why are they selling it through your classifieds?
Well, I think that comes down to a credibility of the platform. The thing is that one thing we've done all the way through our existence is we've operated on a system of trust. Yeah. Trust with our advertisers, trust with our readers. We've not tried to shy away from pretending that we are above our readers. We're just a whole bunch of mountain bikers like everybody else. You know, our skill levels are pretty much average. So I think we're very relatable, and that's built this level of trust over the years. And so the entire platform, how we operate, how we deal with the industry, how we deal with our readers, we have this level of credibility that means that when we launched the classifieds, people trusted the platform. And so, I mean, it is huge. There's 150,000 page impressions a month just in the forum. I think there's around about sort of 30,000 people use it on a regular basis. I think, to be honest, though, all of the options out there, like eBay and Facebook sales groups and things like that, I think people use them not exclusively. And ours is just another tool in there to reach a different kind of audience and gives people a greater chance of selling.
Oh, I can see that, but at least they're doing it. Are you making money from your classifieds?
Not a lot. We have a system whereby if you want to stick, it's kind of old school again. It's a bit yellow pages. If you want to stick your ad to the top and make it stand out, then you can pay a tenner for, and it sits there for 3 months. Yeah. So we have a small amount of revenue.
But it's a more kind of reader service than a.
It is, yeah. I mean, there's advertising on there as well, so there's that
again. You're at the smaller end of the publishing ecosystem. How do you survive? You guys are going almost 20 years. It's not easy. You'd be the first one to say it's not easy. What's the secret to survival? Well, actually, more than that, what's the secret to success? Because you're growing, right?
Yeah, we are. I mean, we're 1.5 million uniques a month coming to the website. The secret, I think, is that you've got to love what you do. I mean, we started this as mountain bikers because, you know, it was a hobby, and we turned it into a job. And I think this is the secret with, or it's the key to all specialist media. You cannot be successful in the specialist media market if you're not really into the subject matter. And also give up any ideas of ever getting rich from it. So if you can, reconcile yourselves with those two criteria, then I think you've got a chance of surviving.
Well, it's easier to reconcile yourself to the second if you've got the first, isn't it?
Well, that's true. Yes.
I mean, the thing that comes through on that is your social media presence. You've got almost 50,000 followers on Instagram. I think you've got more or less the same 55,000 on Twitter. I don't know what you've got on Facebook.
We've got just over 500,000 on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. So that enthusiasm clearly comes through, I think. When you look at, you know, I'm looking at your Instagram feed, it just looks like fun. Looks like you want to be part of that group of people.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's it. It's that relatability. We do have fun. I mean, it's stressful as well. You know, we've all got mortgages and we all have to pay the bills. Yeah, yeah. But at the end of the day, we're writing about bicycles. And if you can't do that and have fun at the same time, then it's time to do something else.
Absolutely. I think that's true for any magazines. Well, look, one thing that I did want to ask you about was your sub in a box. I think that's a brilliant idea. Tell me about that.
The sub in a box. This is almost historic now. I think we started this over 10 years ago. We were like any magazine, trying to sell subscriptions as gifts so that you get your grandma would buy it for you at Christmas. And the feedback we got was the difficulty of selling a subscription is it's something that's almost intangible. It's something that comes at some point in the future. And buying a subscription was always the case of you'd open a card and there'd be some note in it saying, I've bought your subscription to this magazine. It'll turn up at some point. I've got no idea when. And then you sat there and then maybe 2 months later, something had dropped through the door. So we simply just put whatever the current issue is, we put it in a box. We put it in a very nice box with a code in that would activate the subscription. And then we sell that as a gift so that whoever buys it can hand it over. They can even wrap it up and stick it under the Christmas tree. And it worked a treat. It's our best-selling product of the year, most of them, you know, even though we sell the vast majority of them in November and December.
Is there anything else in the box that, you know, is it just a magazine or is there other stuff?
Oh, there's a latest issue of the magazine in there. We've combined them with all kinds of things. We've done some in a box with other merchandise that we've got. So we've done some in a box with a T-shirt. We've done some in a box with. We even make our own coffee. So we've got single track deadline blend coffee, and we do a subscription. We do an actual coffee subscription. So because we work with a coffee roaster in Kirby Lonsdale, who actually roasts our coffee for us. And if you can subscribe to the single track coffee subscription, and 1 month you'll get a bag of coffee, and then the next month you get the magazine. So you get something every month. So I guess that the key is just trying to take that subscription product and modify it and adapt it and just try and keep doing new things with it.
It's making it special, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we always finish up by asking for a recommendation. What media have you loved recently?
There's a podcast I tune into every Tuesday. And despite what I've said about programmatic and how I absolutely hate it, there is one company in the programmatic sphere called Azoic who produce a podcast called The Publisher Lab. And it's fantastic. It's very techie. I'm very much into analyzing data and graphs and things. It's very much about SEO, but it's all from the point of view of publishers. And despite the fact it's put together by a programmatic company, they are very, very independent. They don't try and sell you stuff. They just talk about the latest issues in publishing. So if you're into optimizing your website for SEO and things like that, then I can highly recommend The Publisher Lab.
So we are still planning to be at FIP's Digital Innovators Summit in a couple of weeks. We've got our flights all booked to Berlin. We're going to be doing a live podcast to close the conference. So yeah, if you want to learn more about that, go to innovatorsummit.com.
Fingers crossed.
And if you want to keep up with who won what awards at the Publishers Podcast Awards, you can check them out on the Media Voices website, voices.media, or go straight to the Publishers Podcast Awards website. And at the Media Voices website, you can sign up for our newsletter, and we'll give you a regular update on what's been going on in the news. And if you want daily updates, follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod.
So next week we'll be back with another great guest, and hopefully back to the full complement of Media Voices presenters. But until then,
stay safe, citizens.
Bye.
Bye.